Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, May 12th. Today, believe it or not, is Election Day. Two special elections to fill vacant congressional seats, one in a rural part of Wisconsin, one in the suburbs north of LA. They both have implications for the presidential election this November. The Wisconsin election is in an increasingly Republican district. Now, if the Democrat does well, loses even, but does better than expected, it would show widespread unhappiness with President Trump's pandemic response, presumably. The California election is important, partly because of how people are voting. Governor Gavin Newsom sent every voter in the district a mail-in ballot, but they can also vote in person today. According to the New York Times, the mail-in so far indicate people in the older, whiter Republican parts of the district have voted more than those in the younger, more Latino areas. And because of a late addition of an extra in-person polling place, President Trump has tweeted in advance that the election is being rigged. Get ready for November. With me now, New York Magazine national politics reporter Gabe DeBenedetti, who has a piece called Biden is Planning an FDR-sized Presidency, and New York Times Magazine staff writer Emily Bazelon, who has an article now with the headline, Will Americans Lose Their Right to Vote in the Pandemic? She is also a Yale Law School fellow, Slate Political Gabfest member, and author of the book Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Hi, Emily. Hi, Gabe. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Emily, let me ask you a few questions first, then a few for Gabe, then we'll all talk, and we'll all take some phone calls. What an interesting experiment in California today. The state sent everyone a mail-in ballot, and the polls are open. How much do you see this as a test run for November?
I think it's an important test run because the appetite for voting by mail is going to be greater in November. And this is a big logistical challenge for the country. California has a fairly high rate of voting by mail. It's in the 60%, but there are a lot of states where it's below 10%. And what that means is that even though people have a legal right to request an absentee ballot, even if they're just at home and they don't have an excuse, the task of actually pulling off millions of people voting by mail is one that some states haven't really tried before. And figuring out how that actually works, how to make sure you have the supply chain so that all the ballots go out on time, they come back, they're handled properly, the signatures are verified, all of those things the states need to be learning how to do and figuring out. And so watching California invite people to vote by mail is a good step along the way, a good dress rehearsal.
Although you do note in your article that even as Republicans dig in on this position that voting by mail is bad for them and argue that it's subject to voter fraud, all the major swing states, you point out, in the presidential race already have laws on the books that give voters the right to request an absentee ballot without any particular reason. That's Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina, and Arizona. But only Arizona is already set up for most people to vote by mail. Can you explain what that looks like and expand on your first answer? Being set up for most people to actually vote by mail, what would it take in every state?
Yeah. So what happens in the five states that have what's called universal vote by mail, and now I'm talking about Utah, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and Hawaii. In those states, every registered voter gets an absentee ballot in the mail before the election. And then the voter has a choice. You can send them back through a mail by putting a stamp on it. You can drop it off in a secure drop-off box where you live, or you can bring it to a polling place. And it's important to remember that these states do keep polling places open, not as many of them, but they have on in-person voting for people who don't have stable mailing addresses, just prefer to vote in person, or who have certain disabilities like blindness, which makes it easier for them to vote with assistance at a polling place. So it changes the balance of the election to a mail female election without taking away all the choices. And what you need to pull it off is a system that's set up to be have lots of processing of absentee ballots. So it's like pretty nitty gritty. You need vendors that have expensive machinery that allows them to mass produce the ballots. You need machinery when they come back in so they can be quickly tabulated. And you need to train poll workers to verify signatures so people don't get disenfranchised for signing their names in a way that's unfamiliar. One of the people I consulted for my story said, you know, look, like signature verification could be the hanging chads of 2020 if we don't get this right and figure it out ahead of time.
And before we bring in Gabe, the headline of your New York Times Magazine article asks if people might lose their right to vote in the pandemic. What are the biggest threats to the right to vote that you're focused on?
Well, the kind of nightmare scenario here is that the pandemic remains a threat and state officials try to close polling places in certain areas where it would benefit their party to have fewer people vote. So, for example, you could imagine the polling places getting closed in a city like Detroit or Philadelphia that's a Democratic stronghold if Republican officials were making those decisions. Or you could imagine vice versa, Democratic officials making that kind of move. I think that's a really scary idea, that you use the pandemic in a partisan fashion to limit people's right to vote. And another potential problem is a legal challenge over the counting of ballots, perhaps absentee ballots, if a state isn't accustomed to doing that and there start to be delays or people get nervous about how that process is working. You can easily imagine that litigated. And I think for a lot of us who remember 2000, the ghost of Bush versus Gore and that very contentious, lengthy, damaging litigation is, you know, kind of looms.
All right, Gabe DeBenedetti from New York Magazine. Your article is called Biden is Planning an FDR-Sized Presidency. And your premise is that a candidate who won his primaries on a message of back to normalcy rather than revolutionary change is now planning this massive government response to whatever state of the pandemic we're in come January when he would be sworn in. But, you know, President Trump has already signed trillions of dollars of relief measures and seems to like the look himself of giving taxpayers all that money. So what's the contrast that Biden is setting up to draw?
Yeah, well, I think what's very important here to note when we talk about the idea of an FDR-sized presidency, it's not as if this is an ambition that Joe Biden has long harbored, rather that he has recently, while he's been sort of in his bunker in Wilmington, been looking out at the landscape of the world, but particularly of the country economically these days, and has said to his advisors a few times now, we need to be thinking of a response on the order of, you know, World War II and New Deal spending to the Great Depression, and not these, you know, one-off sort of stimulus packages that have already passed in Washington. What he has said is that he wants to see significantly more spending, but not just in terms of, you know, individual relief checks to families. He's also talked about massive green energy and infrastructure spending. He's talked about building, for example, a public health jobs corps on the order of 100,000 people. So these are obviously massive changes that he's trying to make to the economy, which, of course, is quite a big shift, as you said, from the Joe Biden that we all think we know politically. And obviously, this is all going to be a massive political haul that he would need to get the Senate on board for. But this is the sort of scope of things that he's now thinking about, at least with his advisors, in terms of the path forward. And the case that he has made is essentially, you know, when Donald Trump is looking at the recovery, all he wants is for the top line economic numbers to look good again so that he can make that case for his reelection. But when it comes to actually helping fix the economy on a longer term basis, it's going to take much more than that.
You note in your piece that while Trump is out there every day doing news conferences or publicity stunts with CEOs or whatever, you didn't say publicity stunts with CEOs, I said that, Biden has been giving interviews, but nobody seems to notice. Give me both halves of that. What interviews and who's not noticing?
Well, Joe Biden has done, you know, dozens of interviews with, in many cases, actually local reporters in a lot of the battleground states, but also national interviews. He's been on TV quite a few times, does a lot of late night interviews, and he also does, you know, some daytime news interviews. The point that I was trying to get to there, and that, you know, a lot of people who are around Joe Biden say, is Yeah, there has been this line of argument over the last few months, especially since everything has sort of locked down here, that Biden has really been absent in the national conversation here as Trump has completely dominated it, wherein the reality is that Biden is trying. It's just that obviously when we have such an all-consuming political, well, not even political, but national, international moment such as this pandemic, it's very difficult for someone who's not in charge of anything, like Joe Biden, to actually break through. So he has articulated a lot of these points that I write about in this story. It's simply that when you talk to, and this bears out in the national polling, when you talk to voters, when you see what they're paying attention to right now, they simply aren't that aware of what Joe Biden is talking about. And this is a central struggle that his campaign has been trying to reckon with, when it comes to fixing its digital operation, trying to make sure that more people know about the studio in his basement that he's broadcasting from. At the same time, he still leads in most national and many battleground state polls. And he's said to his friends, listen, Trump can go out there all he wants, but people don't like to hear what Trump is actually saying these days.
And Gabe, before we go back to Emily, is the Biden campaign at all focused on the access to voting issues, which could be make or break, that Emily is writing about?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I was thinking about just as I was listening to Emily talk there. I think that there are a lot of people in the Biden campaign who are very worried about this. And Joe Biden himself does talk about it in the broadest terms. He often says something like, we have to be aware, we have to be careful, we have to be prepared for Republican efforts to, stop Democratic populations from voting in November. But it's not as if he's necessarily signed on to a lot of the legislation that has been shared by the Democratic lawmakers in the Senate or the House right now. And for the most part, I think he is in the let's be aware of this, let's make sure this doesn't happen stance. But I'd be curious to hear Emily's thought on what Joe Biden has said.
Emily?
Well, his Twitter account tweeted my story, so he had that awareness. Someone did, which was interesting. I think that the DNC is pretty focused on ensuring access. And in various states, they've been hiring lawyers to do what they call voter protection work. And this can involve, working with the state or suing the state over their rules for signature verification of absentee ballots. That's one thing they've been doing. And also, they're focused on this kind of obscure but important development, which is that since the 80s, there's been a nationwide consent decree that has barred the Republican National Committee from funding what's called ballot security work. This is election monitoring at the polls that can verge into voter intimidation and has a kind of ugly racial history of Republican operatives showing up at polls and intimidating Black voters and Latino voters. So the RNC can go back to funding this kind of work this year. And in cities like Detroit, I heard a lot of awareness about making sure that the Democratic National Committee's lawyers are also at the polls, making sure that African American and Latino voters have full access to the franchise there.
Gabe, any reaction to Emily's article, now that she's reacted to you, on voting rights and where it intersects with Biden becoming FDR or hunkered in his bunker?
Well, obviously, I think, as Emily just alluded to there, there are a lot of people in the broader Democratic Party who are very aware that in order for any of these things that Joe Biden is talking about to actually happen, there has to be a fair election in the view of a lot of these people. And this is something that the broader Democratic Party has been thinking about a lot. And he does talk about it. But I think that in terms of him putting out his priorities right now and people who are directly around Joe Biden, they don't talk about this as much as a long-term priority, as something that needs to be fixed right now in terms of the coronavirus crisis. So I think that there are a lot of people in the party more broadly who would love to be hearing a longer-term argument from Joe Biden on the broader election issue. But it is something that we know that he's aware of. It's just not something that they're talking about every single day. Though, as Emily said, the broader Democratic Party, the DNC, has invested quite a lot in this sort of short-term fight.
Gabe, I tend to keep multiple TVs on with the different cable news channels on. We have that at the office usually, and now I have it in my apartment. You should see my Con Ed bill. But while Trump shows up on Fox all the time, Biden is not the lead voice of opposition on MSNBC. Those tend to be public health people aligned with Biden, who you mentioned in your article, like Dr. Zeke Emanuel and Dr. Irwin Redlener and Obama's so-called Ebola czar, Ron Klain, plus various members of Congress. Have the Biden people decided not to overexpose him, or what's that about?
It's been an ongoing conversation. He'd love to be out there more is the general consensus here. At the same time, he's not running anything, and I think that they're very careful, and he is very careful about not simply wanting to make it look like just a political response. And this is certainly to the frustration of a lot of Democrats who'd love to see a more forceful response from Joe Biden to what Trump is saying. But the case that those around Biden have made when this is posed to them is essentially he is talking about these things in a proactive sense. He's talking about what he would like to do. But in terms of trying to bookend what the administration is saying, they simply don't want to have a situation where Biden is forced to just be the responder to Trump every day. That's not really a political dynamic that they want. There is, however, quite a bit of frustration, as we were alluding to earlier, that there is not this broader understanding of what Joe Biden actually wants to happen here, despite the fact that, you know, everything that I point to in this article in terms of what he would like, what he has proposed, and what he wants out of the recovery and the response to the crisis. These are all things he's said publicly. It's simply that has not become a part of the national narrative in a way that you would want to see at this point, perhaps in a national election. Obviously, they think that's going to change as the next few months develop and as people start to look for places other than Donald Trump for their answers. But for now, the Biden campaign has been pretty happy to rely on governors and then other surrogates. You know, Biden does talk to a lot of these governors pretty regularly, including Cuomo, including Jay Inslee, Gavin Newsom, Gretchen Whitmer. So he is keyed into what's happening, even if he's not the face of it.
Now I think we have Jane and Chelsea. Hi, Jane, you there?
I certainly am.
Thanks for calling.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you just fine.
Okay. On April 15th, I mailed out a group of payments to Verizon, to Visa, etc. They have not yet received my payments. And I would like to know how the U.S. Post Office, which is obviously in dire straits right now, can possibly deal with a vote in nationally or even statewide. I mean, it's crazy to think about, because you send in your vote and it will arrive maybe, if you're lucky, 2 months later. I have not even received a bank statement in over a month.
Jane, it's a great point. And Emily, it's not the first story that I've heard of people's mail not being delivered in the prompt fashion it usually is, sometimes because postal workers are out sick and for other reasons. And the parallel story, as we talk about the imperative of voting by mail to protect voting rights, is that the post office might go bankrupt in the fall. So what are you thinking when you hear Jane?
Yes, this is a big issue. If we have a mostly vote-by-mail election, the Postal Service becomes a kind of de facto national election administrator. And you're right, the Post Office is warning that it's going to run out of money at the end of September. Unfortunately, this has become a partisan issue. It is Democrats who are talking about funding the Post Office and Republicans who are talking about not doing so. And given the role in the election and the importance of correcting problems like the one, Jane, you're experiencing, it just seems imperative that the post office be able to function. You know, there's also this weird political wrinkle to this, which is that the Postal Service is even more important in rural communities where there tend to be lots of Republicans than it is in cities where people have more options to use UPS or FedEx. And so the idea that we're going to let the Postal Service wither at this moment where people, especially in rural communities, are very dependent on it during the pandemic, it just seems very politically curious. And I wonder if in the end, that pushback from state and local officials will get the Republicans on board to provide some of the needed funding.
Carmela in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carmela.
Oh, hey there. So this is a question for Emily. I read in the news that some Republican, boards of election have tried to close Democratic polling stations for what seem to me specious public health concerns, like there are not enough handicapped bathrooms, there are not enough handicapped parking spaces. And it strikes me that similar arguments can be made to close public polling places in areas of concentrated population, which tend to vote Democratic, quote-unquote fears of spreading the virus, whereas voting places in suburban and rural districts remain open. So I'm wondering what legal precedents they would have to make such a claim, and I'm wondering how likely you think it is that they would do this and that it might be effective in closing polling places and affecting the election.
Emily?
That is a great question. So you're right. So in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted this key part of the Voting Rights Act that had made the Justice Department oversee changes to voting, things like closing polling places. And so the Justice Department had kind of functioned as this like election monitor across the country. Now the Justice Department doesn't play that role anymore. And since then, about 1,600 polling places have closed. And you're right that there have been allegations that that happens more often in predominantly African-American precincts. So that's a problem going forward. And the notion that you could use the pandemic as a public health emergency to close polling places, that's a very real threat. A lot of states have pretty vague laws about what the governor or the health secretary is allowed to do as an emergency order. And so you could imagine those kinds of orders, and then you can imagine a lot of legal challenges to them. I do think that, you know, there are political costs to being seen as closing polling places for partisan reasons, and it sort of depends on your state and how closely, how much competition between the parties there is in the state, what kind of consequences there are for those kinds of moves. But it is definitely something to keep an eye on because, you know, one would hope that the right to vote would be something we could all sort of embrace in this nonpartisan fashion, but that has really not been the history in the country also, in the last several decades.
Also, Emily, it's been the Republicans, led by the president, who've been for opening things and accusing Democrats of being snowflakes when they think things need to be closed more. So that's an obstacle politically to Republicans saying, oh, it's unsafe to go vote in person, or, you know, maybe those contradictions don't just don't register anymore.
Right. I mean, consistency is like a big ask for some politicians right now. But you're right. I mean, what happened in Wisconsin in April, where the election was really a debacle, it took place in the middle of the pandemic. Maybe you read or saw these photos of people standing in long lines. What happened that day was that the Republican leader of the state assembly got on Facebook Live and said, oh, it's incredibly safe to vote. Now, he was wearing like full protective gear, mask, gloves, like a surgical gown. And so he was widely mocked, but he was the one saying it's safe to go to the polls. And so there is some, you know, contradictory messaging there if Republicans started to close polling places, especially if they did it selectively.
Gabe, your article about Biden says he's dealing with the Tara Reid accusations, and he and his advisors believe he will survive them. What's that belief based on, and what's their strategy?
Well, their strategy thus far has been to flatly deny the accusations, and he has called for the release of the complaint that she says that she filed in 1993 that she has said would detail how she went to some of his aides at the time and complained of treatment, though of mistreatment, though she said that would not necessarily mention alleged sexual assault or use the term sexual harassment. But Biden has tried to figure out a way to get that released, in his words or in his team's words, if it exists. They've now gone a little bit more on the offensive and said that her story is very inconsistent and not credible. But they've tried not to get into the back and forth too much over this. She obviously has continued to speak out with her accusation, but they believe that, especially as a lot of voters turn to the general election, that they'll simply have to press on and then, you know, get past this one way or the other. Again, Biden has, you know, denied it from the start.
Emily, on Morning Joe recently, co-host Mika Brzezinski read out loud brief summaries of all 19 outstanding charges of harassment or assault against President Trump, to make the point that any story about Biden in the presidential race context, in addition to on its own merits, needs to be seen as a comparison. But Trump has been defending Biden as probably falsely accused. What do you see as the politics of all that?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think that it is certainly true that if you were weighing these records, even if you give Tara Reid credit for what she's saying, and you look aside from all the inconsistencies. And I do think there are ways in which her story, particularly about reporting this allegation, has changed that may, you know, need more checking. Even if you credit that, the accusations against President Trump are many more. They have that quality of a pattern of assault allegations that we've come to look for in the Me Too era as one way of checking to see if these things are true. There's just no question that they weigh more. I think Republicans, particularly in light of the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh, who's now on the Supreme Court, have taken the stance that it's not okay for long ago allegations that are not easily confirmed to be besmirching someone's reputation. And so you see Trump defending Biden on those grounds. It's a way of kind of taking the sting away from the allegations against himself, right? And this was also true. Tucker Carlson on Fox News did this recently. I feel like in some ways the Republicans are saying to the Democrats, you've gone too far in letting allegations with shaky proof take control of how of these narratives, and we're going to show you a better way to do this.
New York Times Magazine staff writer Emily Bazelon, who has an article now with the headline, Will Americans Lose Their Right to Vote in the Pandemic? She is also a Yale Law School fellow, Slate Political Gabfest member, and author of the book Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration, and New York Magazine national politics reporter Gabe DeBenedetti, who has a piece called Biden is Planning an FDR-sized Presidency. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.